from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Saudi warplanes continued into the second month of air attacks on Yemen. In the latest airstrikes, fighter jets bombed a historical castle called Cairo in the southeastern city of Taiz. The Saudis also hit residential areas in the provinces of Baida and Sa'ada. Even international relief organizations were targeted by the aerial attacks. Saudi planes pounded the headquarters of the United Nations Children's Fund. The attacks came as the Iran Shahid, a ship carrying humanitarian aid to Yemen, approached the shores of the country. Press TV's Khaniz Fatima has more.
Press TV's Matthew Jamshidi now joins us from that cargo vessel to tell us a bit more about the progression. Now, Matthew, I do understand that there will be an UN inspection of this ship, and there is a lot of anticipation to get this aid relief to the people as quickly as possible in Yemen. Tell us a bit more.
As you said, I'm on board the humanitarian aid vessel named the Iran Shahid, bound for the war-torn country of Yemen. The mission has been coordinated with the UN and International Red Cross since the beginning. We set sails for Hodeidah port in Yemen Monday, May 11th. We have had a long journey since we crossed the Sea of Oman, Indian Ocean, and now Gulf of Aden. The Iranian officials have been very clear and open about the inspection of this ship through the UN all the way. They insisted that the ship will be open to any kind of inspection by the UN, but not to the US or the Saudi Arabia. Right now, in order to do an inspection, we are headed to the port city of Djibouti, which of course is in the country of Djibouti and in Africa. You can just see the Djibouti port behind me right now. It is across the Strait of Bab el-Mandab, across from Yemen, and it is in Africa. We will dock there in less than an hour. I can see the docks right now, and the situation in Yemen, as reports describe, is nothing less than a catastrophe.
The Saudi air attacks against Yemen, which are backed by U.S. intelligence and maintenance crews, began on March 22nd. More than 3,700 people, mostly civilians, have been killed in the nearly 2 months since. The fighting has caused a mass exodus of foreign nationals from Yemen to neighboring countries. Press TV's Abdul Azizbullah reports from the Somali capital of Mogadishu.
It's home at last for these 95 Somali nationals who have been safely evacuated back to the Somali capital, Mogadishu, after fleeing the conflict in Yemen. The plane carrying the Somalis landed at the country's international airport and was received by a high-ranking government delegation that included the country's first lady. Most of the evacuees are women, children, and the elderly.
We fled for our lives and God saved us. We were not hurt thanks to our government's efforts. The Somali government took us from there. We returned safe and sound. This is my home country. I will never leave come what may.
Thousands of Somali nationals and Yemeni refugees have also been received by relevant authorities in the other regions of Somalia, namely Puntland and Somaliland. Not only Somalis, but thousands of other foreign nationals have fled Yemen after Saudi Arabia started pounding key targets in late March.
We're very pleased to be able to help the government of Somalia in cooperation, very close cooperation with IOM. On this very, innovative collaboration on bringing people back from Yemen. So we have all of the standard services available for the returnees in cooperation with IOM here at the airport. And we wish the government of Somalia every success as they welcome their nationals home.
The Saudi invasion of Yemen has displaced more than 500,000 people, according to UN officials. Somalia itself is among the poorest countries in Africa and is facing a humanitarian crisis as refugees from Yemen, both Somalis and Yemenis, are fleeing the conflict in Yemen. And with no solution at hand to the escalating crisis in Yemen, UN Chief Ban Ki-moon and the country's Prime Minister Omar Abdelrashid have both warned that the conflict in Yemen risks threatening the security of the whole region. Abdulaziz Bilal, Press TV, Mogadishu.
Meanwhile, the response from Yemen is now being felt inside Saudi Arabia itself, with Yemeni troops capturing Saudi territory and killing Saudi troops inside the kingdom. Press TV's Hassan Tavakoli has more.
The Yemeni army and Ansarullah fighters continue their retaliatory attacks against Saudi forces in border areas. The forces are reportedly taking control of Tawal Heights in Saudi Arabia's Jizan region near the border with Yemen. Earlier, Yemen's Arabic TV channel Al Masira reported nearly 20 Saudi soldiers were killed in a retaliatory attack on Saudi military positions near Dahran. Saudi military equipment was also destroyed in the attack. The channel said Saudi spy planes were flying over the country's western Sadr province and border areas. Yemeni forces have also fired dozens of rockets into Saudi military positions in border areas. Attacks on Saudi border regions began earlier this month, weeks after the Saudi kingdom launched its aggression against its impoverished neighbor. The Swiss city of Geneva will host UN-sponsored talks next week aimed at resolving the ongoing crisis in Yemen. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon has urged all parties to engage without preconditions. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has backed the talks. Its leader, Abdul Malik Houthi, denounced the Saudi war, saying Riyadh will face the consequences of its aggression against Yemen.
The leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says Saudi Arabia is losing and will face the consequences of its aggression against the impoverished country. Abdul Malik al-Houthi also said the Saudi attacks only showed the criminality, tyranny and absence of ethics. The already poor Yemen has plunged further into trouble amid Saudi airstrikes, as well as an air and sea blockade, which began nearly 2 months ago. The airstrikes have hit different parts of Yemen on a daily basis, destroying its infrastructure and causing growing casualties, mostly civilians. According to UN estimates, nearly 500,000 people have also been displaced. The aerial attacks have intensified over the past few weeks, with Riyadh saying they will continue until they achieve their goals. Saudi Arabia says its campaign is aimed at restoring fugitive former President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi through fighting his opponents that are Ansarullah and its army allies. Ansarullah fighters and their allies are also fighting Al-Qaeda militants and have managed to gain ground despite the Saudi strikes. At the same time, Yemeni tribes have continued attacks on Saudi border areas, causing more casualties among the Saudis. The Yemenis began the border assaults earlier this month, saying they're in retaliation for the Saudi airstrikes. Experts believe that the retaliatory attacks show Saudi Arabia's vulnerability.
Although ill-equipped and maybe even ill-trained, the Yemeni fighters are able to throw a painful blow to the Saudi army that is well equipped, as you can see people with their light weapons versus tanks, that the most modern tanks that may be in the Middle East. So that shows that with some Yemeni preparation, they can actually launch an attack that might stop the war if they are able to coordinate their attacks. So, and it shows that Saudi vulnerability.
In an effort to resolve Yemen's crisis, the United Nations has set May 28th, the date for peace talks among rival groups. Ansarullah has backed the talks in Switzerland, saying they are the only solution to the conflict. Riyadh insists that Iran has no place in the upcoming talks.
There is no place for Iran in the consultations in Geneva. They have not been playing a constructive role and as such cannot be rewarded by having a seat at the table.
Iran has time and again called for an end to the Saudi aggression against Yemen. Tehran says Yemen's internal problems must be resolved through talks among the Yemeni factions and that foreign states should only play the role of facilitator.
A massive demonstration in Argentina as people took to the streets to protest against U.S. and U.K. meddling in Latin America. The rally came in the wake of recent announcements of new U.S. and U.K. military deployments in the region and was attended by a number of top regional diplomats calling for the end of the U.S. embargo on Cuba and sanctions against Venezuela. Press TV's Manuel Gafani reports from Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires.
Demonstrators from social movements, community groups, and workers' unions gathered in Buenos Aires to protest the U.S. and U.K. imperialism in Latin America. The move follows the recent moves by the U.S. State Department and the U.K. Ministry of Defense, who announced the deployment of new bases and the beef up of their existing military capabilities in countries like Colombia and Paraguay, among many others, and in territories like the Malvinas Islands. Protesters say the main U.S. and U.K. corporations play a key role when it comes to the control of strategic resources.
Pero lo que yo quería destacar es el
Many
tema
of the U.S. and UK attempts to meddle in our countries are carried out by their corporations. For instance, companies like Monsanto seize control of the agricultural resources, and the banking institutions try to exert political and economic pressures to the government.
The protesters voiced their anger against the U.S. and UK growing interference in Latin America. They also accused these two countries of violating numerous U.N. resolutions, condemning the Malvinas Islands occupation and the crippling U.S. embargo against Cuba. The demonstrators also condemned Washington's attempts to, quote, destabilize Venezuela.
The U.S. and its allies have been constantly threatening our countries. In the past, they supported new liberal governments that brought about social unrest, and now they hinder and block any initiative to change our social and economic policies.
Other Latin American diplomats also joined the demonstration. They called for an end to the Western countries' interference in the region and urged the U.S. and the U.K. to refrain from new military deployments.
More than a century ago, the founder of our country already used to say that the worst enemy of Latin America was the establishment in Washington, and time proved he was right. They must stop the military expansionism.
Next month, social movements from all over Latin America will gather in Uruguay in a historic meeting, which will aim to put together a united front against threats posed by the Western powers to the regional governments. Manuel Gifoni, Press TV, Buenos Aires.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea has canceled a planned trip to the country by the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. The Secretary General was due to visit the Kaesong Industrial Complex, a joint project of North and South Korea, on Thursday. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
The two countries have continued to endure strained relations following the division of Korea in 1945. No explanation was given for the cancellation of the visit, which the UN described as a last-minute change. The UN chief, Mr. Ban, who is a South Korean national, said the decision was deeply regrettable. But he said he would not spare any effort to encourage the DPRK to work with the international community for peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. The visit would have been the first by a UN Secretary General in more than 20 years. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Is a U.S. war with China on the horizon?
Of all the times in history when a rising power, in this case China, comes up against a status quo power, in this case the United States, 70% of the times in history, the result has been war. So only 30% of the time has it been worked out.
So the odds are for war.
That's the fundamental issue we're talking about here. That's how important this is.
And you think war is a real risk?
Yes.
That was former CIA Director Michael Morell speaking with CNN's Aaron Burnett Wednesday. That conversation came in the context of a series of recent encounters between the navies and air forces of the U.S. and China in the South China Sea, and in the midst of joint naval maneuvers in the Mediterranean involving the navies of China and Russia. For more on this, we spoke with Eric Dratzer, a New York-based commentator on international affairs and the publisher of the website StopImperialism.org.
The notion that China is challenging U.S. military and political hegemony in its own backyard is not only an important story, it's a story for really that really makes the decade, and it makes an entire generation in terms of the political significance of it. Were they to acknowledge the true political significance of it and the geopolitical context of it, it would completely reframe the way that the people of the United States think about the position of their country in the world, because, of course, my generation, your generation, perhaps even your parents' generation, has very little understanding of what it would be like to live in a world where the U.S. is not a global hegemon, is not able to exert its will in all corners of the globe. And a story like China challenging the U.S. in the South China Sea, it calls that assumption into question.
And, you know, that challenge is not only taking place in the South China Sea. While this whole story has been developing and you had the quote-unquote encounter with the U.S. warship and a Chinese warship the other day, and then these plane incidents, the Prime Minister of China was in Brazil, another BRICS country, signing huge deals, and China is all over Latin America and the Caribbean with massive investments right now.
Well, that's right, and that's a challenge to economic hegemony as well. And, of course, The Chinese have made a number of different moves in recent months and in recent years, various ways in which they're challenging U.S. hegemony. Not only does it come in the form of investments all over Africa, which is well known, well documented, all over Latin America, as you were just implying. Of course, recently we know that the news was littered with stories about the Chinese and the Russians signing very significant military deals and other important agreements. But of course, also the fact that the Chinese are now challenging the very institutions of global neoliberal finance capital dominated by the U.S. and its Western allies. That is to say, challenging the hegemony of the IMF, challenging the hegemony of the World Bank by establishing the BRICS Development Bank, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, dominated and founded by the Chinese. So in various ways, the Chinese are not only building an architecture that is challenging the U.S., it's really running in parallel to the U.S.-dominated system. And in many ways, this is a challenge not only against America's global hegemony, but really a challenge against the very fabric of what we've come to know as global capitalism, which for most people, they don't even understand that there are alternative systems to that. And though the Chinese are very much players in the system of global capital, they have their own way of looking at it. They have their own strategies. They have their own ideas. And the time has come for the Chinese, particularly under the leadership and guidance of Xi Jinping and his administration, the Chinese are now beginning to exert their influence and beginning to take their rightful place at the head of the global community.
You know, and as far as that goes in terms of alternative models, if you were to look at China's existing economic system, which has characteristics of both socialism and capitalism, and compare it to, say, you know, so calling China a capitalist country, which many on the left do, and it's somewhat accurate, but not entirely, and compare it, say, to France that has a socialist president, for example, or even to, say, the Scandinavian countries at the height of their quote-unquote socialist formations, a huge chunk of that massive economy is in public hands.
Well, that's right, and actually the most significant parts of China's economy are in the hands of the government and in the hands of the people of the country, because what you are referring to in terms of Scandinavia and Western Europe in general, this is not really socialism. They use the banner of socialism as really the face of what should be rightly called social democratic capitalism. They have a welfare state, they have benefits, they have labor unions and all of the rest of that, but it is ultimately private ownership, private wealth, capital. That is to say, they really are part and parcel of the global capitalist system, and in the last 40 years, they've become major players in the transformation to a neoliberal model of global capitalism. China, on the other hand, in many ways has used the neoliberal model in order to enrich itself, taking its place as the so-called, you know, the factory of the world, but at the same time, China has maintained really close elements of what could be called a socialist model or a communist model, however you want to describe it, in the sense of state ownership, public utilities, public wealth. And so if you look at the investments that the Chinese make in places like Africa and in Latin America and really all over the world, the vast majority of it is made by the state. They're not made by private corporations. Even those private corporations ultimately are beholden to the state. They act under the auspices of the Chinese state, unlike, for instance, in the United States, where it is the corporations that dominate our government, that control our government and control policy. In China, it is really an inversion of that model, and that is part of the reason why, no matter what you call it, it's clearly a different model.
And then an inversion of that, you could look, for example, to Greece prior to Syriza, where you had the socialist government there, PASOK, and elsewhere around Europe, everywhere, including France, where you have socialists presiding over both neoliberal austerity and, in the case of France, even French imperialism.
Well, that's exactly right. And like I said, you know, after World War II, the term socialism in Europe really became an important veneer for capitalism. I mean, socialism as a means of delegitimizing the communist movement that had tremendous reach and tremendous roots in European society. And so you have these quote-unquote socialist parties who more and more, and certainly in the last generation or two, have really become capitalist parties under the auspices of socialism. They drop any pretense of proletarian power. They drop any pretense of workers' struggle. They drop any pretense of class conflict or any of the tenets of what normally would be called socialism. And instead, what they preach is essentially a social democratic version of capitalism. Capitalism with a socialist face. And that's really what Europe became. And so, again, when you hear these right-wing Republicans, really even Democrats, too, in the United States talk about the socialists in Europe, they don't really know what they're talking about, because these are people who don't have any understanding of what socialism is, and they don't have any understanding of how it actually operates. Now, in China, for instance, you have a very different sort of a model, not what Marx envisioned as socialism, but a different sort of a model, one that at this point in history works for China. And if you look around the world and you see what China's been able to do, what China's able to accomplish, how quickly they're able to mobilize resources, how quickly they're able to penetrate with investments, how important they become as far as trading partners, it becomes, I think, inescapable and certainly not debatable that China is not only a major player globally, they are the principal player.
And then coupled with the other countries of the BRICS and the increasingly close military alliance with Russia, that they're a major player in a major bloc that's a counter to the U.S. Imperialism and the U.S.-EU bloc. Looking at the rise of the bloc headed by China with the military power of Russia and the economic power of Brazil, India, and South Africa as it rises, The U.S. is looking at a real challenge globally to its hegemony, both in terms of economic and military power. Do you think in that context that the possibility of a war with China, in the context also of all the deployment of all the military assets against Russia from the Baltic to the Black Sea, and the deployment of military power to Asia that's facing China right now on this South China Sea, that there's a real possibility of war?
Unfortunately, sadly, I do think it's a very real possibility, and I don't take that lightly, and I'm not somebody who is, likely to give in to, wild accusations of a coming apocalypse or anything like this, but unfortunately, any look at history, a basic understanding of history, tells you that when global systems enter into crises, whether it's in the form of collapse or whether it's in the form of a challenge from rising powers, when global systems are thrown into crisis, existential crises, oftentimes it leads to global conflicts. You saw that in 1914. You had a global imperial system with various imperial powers who were in conflict with each other, blocks which began to emerge, and it erupted into the most devastating conflict the world had ever known. World War II is, of course, an extension of those same conflicts from World War I. If you take it a century earlier than that, you had a very similar type of situation in the Napoleonic era. You had a global system, an empire, the British, which had major control over mainland Europe, being challenged by the rise of the French and the French resurgence of the French Empire. Before that, you had the War of Spanish Succession at the beginning of the 18th century. You could point to the beginning of each century as really the moment at which one global system was collapsing and another was rising to challenge it. And in many ways, we should look at what's happening now, just as what you're talking about, the rise of BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the challenge against the global capitalist system, all of these things. This is, in effect, the 21st century version of what we saw at the beginning of the 20th century, a new system rising to challenge the one that has been the dominant hegemon for the previous century. That's incredibly dangerous, and especially if you consider the position of those in power now in Washington and on Wall Street and in the city of London. These people, these imperialists, are always going to act aggressively and belligerently when backed into a corner. And if you look at the collapsing dollar system, the petrodollar especially, you begin to see that their entire edifice, if that is destabilized, the entire edifice of that global system can come crashing down. And that's, of course, tremendously dangerous, and that's how world wars begin.
Yeah, I mean, and in that analysis, you sound remarkably like Morrell, the former CIA director in the interview with Burnett, because he was saying essentially that whenever you have a rising power facing a an existing power that 70% of the time in history that he referred to, there's a war, and that's pretty much what you're laying out. But the situation is even different than the last global competition between the U.S. and the USSR. If you look at the fact that we almost went to nuclear war over Cuba, you now have the specter of this rising BRICS bloc making much deeper penetration right into the Western Hemisphere. The CELAC conference this past year, for example, included China and huge deals. And you have almost unanimous votes on many important issues at UNASUR against the United States and towards a regional integration, with China standing in the wings on that.
Well, that's right. And part of the reason is because this is an outgrowth of U.S. imperialism. Those countries, particularly you're mentioning in Latin America, they're sick and tired of being treated like the whipping boys of the Yankee Empire. This is what they've been going through really for the entire history as far as them being nations.
50 years after the assassination of Malcolm X, whose 90th birthday passed this past Tuesday, BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford speculates about what Malcolm would say if he were to survey the political scene in the U.S. today.
Malcolm X would have been 90 years old on Tuesday if he had not been assassinated at the age of 39 on February 21st, 1965. His impact on Black America, the African diaspora, and on human history is inestimable. But I believe Brother Malcolm's greatest contribution to the struggle for human dignity lay in his unrelenting critique of the political structures and behavior of Black America. Malcolm X made it legitimate and virtuous to engage in full-throated, soul-searching, icon-searing debate about the past, present, and future of those who were then called Negroes. Most importantly, he did not give a damn if white people heard all the black-on-black commotion or not, because they were not his audience, even when his arguments were broadcast on white corporate media. Malcolm's position was that many of these black leaders were actually creatures of the white power structure and its media. He questioned their loyalties and very legitimacy, and challenged black folks to choose their own leaders who would fight uncompromisingly for black interests. Malcolm took on the so-called Big Six, the NAACP, the National Urban League, CORE, SNCC, Dr. Martin Luther King's SCLC, and the legendary A. Philip Randolph, who'd gained the cooperation of the Kennedy administration to hold the 1963 March on Washington. Malcolm was not impressed. He called it the farce on Washington, and derided the Big Six for diluting black people's power by putting cream in the coffee. This was not a catcall for racial exclusion, but a demand for independent black politics. Millions of black people, especially the young, understood Malcolm's meaning and acted upon it. There is no doubt that Malcolm was a race man, but when it came to his analysis of black America, he was a class man, too. His elevation of the field Negro over the fawning, obsequious house Negro was an admonition to resist co-optation into what even Dr. King later recognized was a burning house. Malcolm wielded his house Negro analogy like a sword, shaming and delegitimizing those blacks who identify with and serve oppressive institutions, rather than the interests of the masses of the people. Malcolm's harsh but lucid juxtapositions gave clarity of vision to a movement that would shake America to its foundations. What would Malcolm say if he were returned to us? His critique would begin with the present sorry state of black America, where the house Negro has held sway for the past two generations, with disastrous results. But he would also hear the voices of his great-grandchildren stirring among the field Negroes of Ferguson and Baltimore, and he would say, "Show me a capitalist, and I'll show you a bloodsucker." And then Malcolm would immediately set about denouncing and organizing against those black people that have sided with the bloodsuckers. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.